Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From the outside looking in, Jennifer Pan seemed like a model daughter living a perfect life. The ideal child, the one her immigrant parents saw, was studying to become a pharmacist at the University of Toronto. But there was a dark, deceptive side to the angelic young woman. In reality, Jennifer spent her days in the arms of her high school sweetheart, Daniel. In an attempt to lead the life she dreamed of, she would do almost anything: lie about her whereabouts, forge school documents, and invent fake jobs in a fictitious apartment. For many years, she led this double life. But when her father discovered her web of lies, his ultimatum was severe, and so too was her revenge, a plan that culminated in cold-blooded murder. And it almost worked, except for one bad shot. The story of Jennifer Pan is one of an all-consuming love and devious betrayal that led to a cold-hearted plan hatched by a group of youths who thought that they could pull off the perfect crime. The book that we're featuring this evening is A Dead Daughter's Deadly Deception, the Jennifer Pan story, with my special guest, journalist and author, Jeremy Grimaldi. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Jeremy Grimaldi.
Yeah, it's nice to be here, Dan.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on a very, very interesting story. One of my favorite questions, and I'm always curious, tell us and tell our audience how you came to be this author, why this story was important to you, how you came to this story, A Daughter's Deadly Deception.
I'm a big fatalist. Well, I guess fatalist isn't the right word. I'm a big believer in fate. Fate brought me to this story. I became a crime reporter years after the murder was committed, and the trial started 4 years after the murder was committed, and I happened to be the crime reporter in Markham, where it occurred. When it began, I was the go-to reporter, turned out. It was at a time when a lot of newspapers were cutting back on staff, so right. I became sort of one and only to cover the entire trial. It was a 10-month trial, and by the end, it was so fascinating and so layered that I had really no choice but to write it. It was an important story that had to be told.
Certainly. Now, just before we start, because I know there's a lot of confusion, even for me, born in Ontario, so tell us where Markham is and in relation to Toronto, where our international audience, our American audience, will know more of than, obviously, Markham. So tell us what Markham is and where it is in relation to Toronto.
Sure. Markham was once a small town, and it slowly, as Toronto grew into a metropolitan city, grew out and out, it became a suburb. And, was once white Anglo-Saxon farming community, but slowly it became a suburban town with a growing Chinese population. And at this point, it's about half the city of about 350,000 people are now Asian. I believe that actually half the city is of Chinese origin, and many of them come from a municipality in Toronto called Scarborough. It's a sort of a lower socioeconomic municipality, and a lot of the people who do well in Scarborough, I mean, immigrants since the 50s have landed in Scarborough. That's where people get their start because of the cheap housing. And when those residents do well, a lot of them Chinese, they move north. And just north of Scarborough is Markham. And Jennifer Pan's family was a typical example of this.
Now, the main characters in this story, the Pan family, and you talk about 57-year-old Han Pan and his wife, Bika, and Pan, and they've been together 30 years. And you set this right away. You set with the action and bring the audience in when they are woken from a deep sleep, and Han, the father, meets a man with a baseball bat and in his cap pulled down, basically out of his down on his eyes. So, and he's out of bed demanding money. So, take us to this scene that you bring us to in the book, and what is happening in the Pan home. Maybe before we start that, tell us just a little bit about the Pan family and where they are. You show some photos in there that sets up the scene where this is an affluent part of town anyway, in this suburb, and what Han Pan wakes up to in his home, November 8th, 2010.
Okay, so I'll start off briefly by explaining how they came to be here. The Pans are Chinese, of Chinese origin, who came to Canada from Vietnam after the Vietnamese War. They landed, and as I was saying from the top, they came to Scarborough, managed to purchase a home, and worked at a car parts manufacturer called Magna for 25 years. And both of them worked their fingers to the bone. They were waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning and working the whole day through, working overtime. And eventually saved enough money to move up to Markham and buy a suburban home, four-bedroom home on a very nice street in a place called Unionville, which is the historic part of Markham. Excuse me. And life in the suburban neighborhood was, although it may have seemed positive, it seemed to be negative for Jennifer, and we'll probably get into that later. But Han, again, woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning for his job. He was a tool and die maker. So he would be in bed by 10, 9 sometimes. He went to bed that night. He turned in early and woke up. And you mentioned a baseball bat. It was actually a gun. He was laying in his bed, and a gun was shoved in his face. And a voice came out of the darkness and said, "Where's the effing money?" Han was then awoken from his slumber, turned around without his glasses on, and marched down the stairs with a gun at the back of his head. When he reached the bottom of the stairs, he saw another man holding a gun to the head of his wife, and he was sat on the couch beside his wife. And the first thing his wife asked him in Cantonese, said to him, "How did they get in?" And he responded, "I don't know, I was sleeping." Afterwards, they were berated and beaten briefly. But most of all, they were repeatedly asked for the money, which Han Pan kept replying, "We don't have any money. All I have is $60 that's upstairs in my jean pockets." They ended up getting that money. One of the burglars called to the other, and he ended up getting that money. They were then marched to the bottom of the stairs into the basement, and a blanket was put over Han Pan's head and Bik Ha's head. And Han Pan sat patiently and allowed the blanket to be put over his head. He was then shot twice in the face and the shoulder at point-blank range, and he slumped and fell to the floor. His wife wouldn't allow the blanket to be put on her head. She was panicking. She kept calling out to her daughter, Jennifer, please, you can hurt us, but don't hurt our daughter. The men had no time for this, so without a blanket on her head, the men put the guns up to the back of her skull and fired again, point-blank range, putting two bullets through her brain, and she died.
Now, you talk about what happens next, where the 911 call that's crucial in this entire
mm-hmm.
story.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Jennifer, their daughter. Their son, Felix, is in Hamilton at school, I believe. He's in Hamilton anyway. He's not at home.
Yeah.
Jennifer is there. Tell us, by the time you talk about these gunshots, what is happening at the same time regarding Jennifer?
Okay. So after Bick is shot, she slumps, falls to the floor, and the men leave the home. There's three of them. Jennifer then, who's on the top floor, bound. Her wrists are bound against the banister, bound behind her back, manages to call 911 with a cell phone that's been tucked into her yoga pants. She calls 911, and while she's talking to the operator, screaming, "Help, help me, we've just been robbed," and I heard pops. You hear in the background of the 911 call her father with this sort of blood-curdling scream and moan rising from the basement. He's just awoken from his, I don't know what you'd call it, I guess, after being shot in the face, to find his wife dead. And he's then rising from this and coming up and immediately bolts out of the house. While his daughter is yelling down, "Dad, I'm here, please, Dad," Han runs out the door, and Jennifer's left on the phone talking to the 911 call operator who has police there within minutes.
Now, you talk about Han Pan collapsing in his right in front of his neighbor, Peter Chung.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
and so right on the scene is Constable Mike Stesko, and in broken English, Han somehow incredibly communicates there was a robbery and intruders shot his wife and left his daughter inside. So tell us what Mike Stesko, Constable Mason Baines, and the people right at the scene do and find at the scene.
Sure. Han manages to convey the message that his wife had been shot and he had been shot, because the bullet wound was not visible. He had blood streaming from his face, but the police officers couldn't really see how the blood or where the blood was coming from. So he motioned with his hands, forming a gun and pointing to his head. So the police officers arm themselves, and their backs hit the wall of the home, and they creep inside the home, not knowing who's inside the house or outside. Two of the officers go downstairs and find Bick laying on the floor with a towel partially over her face and a large pool of blood gathering around her head. I believe they described the blood as sort of a bluish red and very thick. When they approached her, one of the officers described her skin. While the other officer took her pulse, he was describing her skin as already gray and blue, her legs. So he knew that she had already, the life had left her. Another officer who was a rookie, he was just new in the country, originally from Scotland, was told to go upstairs and find the daughter who was screaming, Jennifer. So he went upstairs and talked to Jennifer. As he was rising from the stairs, he holstered his gun, thinking that the men had gone because the home looked perfectly still, and all they could hear was Jennifer's screams. When he hollered up to her, "Are they gone? Are they gone?" She answered, oddly enough, answered, "I don't know. I just heard footsteps." So he again pulled out his pistol as he slowly walked up the stairs sideways and found her. He then cleared the three bedrooms that he saw, the four bedrooms, excuse me, and proceeded to get a pair of scissors from Jennifer's nightstand, which she advised him of, to cut the rope that was binding her. She was hysterical, inconsolable, and he, the eternal gentleman, placed his jacket around her shoulders and led her outside, while Han was being put into a stretcher, screaming, still trying to gather his mind around what had just occurred. She said to him as he was being loaded into the ambulance, "Daddy, are you okay?" That was the last thing he heard after being rushed to hospital.
You say he was a rookie, but even that rookie noticed the way she was tied to that banister.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what he did observe, not making any conclusions, but just what he did observe about her being tied to that banister.
He called it Copenhagen's mermaid. Now, if you can imagine a mermaid, the way they may sit on their tail. So she was sitting on the bottom of her feet, but sort of to the side. So her legs were straddling her rear end, which was touching the ground. Her arms were bound behind her, to the banister, and she, I believe, really did well at showing him that she was totally and utterly distraught and distressed, screaming and yelling and hysterical about what had just occurred.
Now, the description she gives to the police is what at that time? What does she say? How good a look does she get? Tell us what she says to police in terms of the three perpetrators she claims were in the home.
So when she's asked, "Were they men?" she says, "I think so." When she's asked what color their skin was, she said, "Black, I think." And when she describes them, she does a very poor job saying anything other than they were wearing hoodies and they had guns. There was nothing she described to the operators that would allow them to get any hints or clues as to who had perpetrated this heinous crime.
Now, you talk about 4 hours later, this Han Pan is clinging to life, and Jennifer is interviewed by Detective Randy Slade, and he's a veteran of the homicide unit. 2-hour interview, and he tells her that the sworn video statement is not accusatory, but it's a guarantee that she tells the truth. And he points out at that time the penalty for lying being 14 years. What does he observe in terms of her reaction to the statements he makes? Again, he doesn't make conclusions, but what does he observe?
Sure. And it's important to realize that at this point, Jennifer was very much the victim. And as far as anyone knew, she was she had been home and was the last surviving victim of a perfectly random home invasion in which two people were shot in the head. One of them died. So, as you can imagine, any sort of inkling that that Randy Slade notes to her that this is he's accusing her, or that he's sort of implying that she may be involved, he sort of apologizes for, because he can really sympathize with what she was going through. So he makes it very clear that she is not a suspect, and she's not a person of interest. She is the victim, and really handles her with kid gloves throughout the first interview.
Now, how far do they go in terms of this interview and that 2 hours of doing anything in terms of confiscating or looking at a warrant for contents of her cell phone?
Nothing. This is, if you can imagine Markham as a place that's so peaceful that there were 14 home invasions the year before. This kind of crime in Canada just does not occur. And
right.
In those home invasions, people are not assaulted, and people are not bound up, and they're certainly not shot or wounded. Usually it's a monetary thing. So for police, who had at this point absolutely no clues, in such a peaceful place, they were really mystified by the crime. Mostly because, in their experience, random crimes don't happen. 99% of the time, a crime is targeted. This, on its face, appeared to be perfectly random. But if you ask any detective, they'll know, and they'll explain to you that crimes aren't random. Men don't drive down a street looking for the biggest house, usually, and then just waltz in with guns demanding money. Usually there's a tip or some information, or they know the person, or they know that there's a safe in the basement. So for police, they were, I would say the accurate term is bewildered, and certainly didn't want to lay blame at Jennifer's feet.
Now, they didn't want to lay blame, but they did assess the crime scene. And in terms of motive for this particularly gruesome murder, what was the likelihood of it, that this motive was robbery, and what didn't they steal, including a Lexus and a Mercedes?
Sure. So when you when you're a detective, from what the detectives working on the case told me, you have to work with the facts. So it may seem bizarre to them that someone just broke in and shot two people and stole a bit of money. But they can't then jump to conclusions and say, well, this seems like an inside job. They have to work with what they've got. So when they enter in the home, they notice that Han Pan's bed has been completely ramshackled by the intruders. They notice that Bic Ha's purse has been rifled through. They also notice that Jennifer had lost $2,000 to the men. So initially, they believed that this was a robbery. Now, particularly inquisitive detectives would have noticed, as you said, that there was still money in Bic Ha's purse. Not much, but certainly $20, $40, $60. The TV was still there. The electronics were still there. Two cars, including a Mercedes and a Benz, were still in the driveway, in the garage, excuse me. So there were hints that something was awry, but far be it from a detective to make accusations based on mere hints.
Same time, what they do is their due diligence, and they have a technique, and they have techniques in terms of further interviews and to look for inconsistencies, to look for, again, reaction, but mostly inconsistencies, and if they can get any more information by a further interview.
Sure.
So there isn't, as you write later, there is no DNA evidence, there is no weapons found, there is no bloody clothing found. So how do police proceed, and tell us about the next interview?
So what police get, what police have at the beginning scares them, I believe. And they put 40 officers on the case because they realize that they have very little. As you said, there is no DNA. There is no weapon. There is no bloody clothes. There are no footprints. Footage from across the street, video surveillance footage of a car driving up, parking, and then driving away, but it's so dark and so poor that it shows very little else. So what they put out as a result of Jennifer's first interview, in which she, by the way, calls the intruders, refers to them as gentlemen at one point, which is another odd sort of happening. So they get that three black male intruders entered into the home. One of them had dreads and was short and stocky. Another was tall with an oval face. And a third seemed to have a Caribbean accent of some sort. But his face was never seen. They also saw that it was a late model silver Acura with tinted windows, similar to a Civic. So this is what really all they have to go on. And then there are these puzzling details, like the two cars are still there, and there's still money there, and there's expensive camera equipment. And there was a safe that was never broken into. So when the second interview comes around, the detectives explain to Randy that he needs to be more forceful with Jennifer because there were some inconsistencies. Now, one of the main inconsistencies, now your sharp listeners will see, may think, how did she call the police, 911, with her cell phone when her hands were bound behind her back? So in the second interview, Randy Slade asks her, gives her a phone, a dummy phone, and says, show me how you called the police with your hands bound behind your back. And this is when you start seeing Jennifer, I don't want to say fall apart, but her behavior becomes very erratic. and she starts cracking her knuckles and pacing and becomes very nervous. And she binds her hands behind her back with imaginary string and seems to pull the phone out of her yoga pants and somehow fashions out of that a call that she could have made. So she says she dials the number and puts it on speakerphone and turns up the volume and talks to the operator in that way. But it's still questionable, I guess you could say. And there are other inconsistencies. They had interviewed her ex-boyfriend, and he had told her about a number of lies that Jennifer had told her parents in a bid to continue to see him. And the detective uses that as a way to sort of unsettle Jennifer to the point where she really starts suffering under the glare of the detective's attention. But again, I have to accentuate that all of this odd behavior and all of these questions that were raised around her on that night are nothing more than that, questions. And detectives need hard evidence to lay charges or to make someone a suspect. And at this point, they had no evidence.
Now, meanwhile, what is the status of Han Pan? The doctor had induced a coma. He was he was in serious condition. So what does the family do? Is there a vigil at the hospital? And what is Jennifer's behavior like at that hospital?
She sees a psychiatrist and is put on a drug similar to lorazepam, I can't remember exactly what it was called, and which dulls her senses and allows her to calm down. And she continues to take that throughout. There is no vigil held. The doctors put him in a coma. And really, I can't accentuate enough that his survival is really miraculous. The bullet that was shot through his face ended up going down through his neck and missing his carotid artery by millimeters. And if it had hit the carotid artery, he would be dead. Instead, the bullet got lodged in his neck, and he was unable to speak when he was revived from the coma. But other than that, he was in pretty good shape.
Are police anxious to talk to him in case he knows something about this case? How crucial of a witness do they think Han Pan, now that he recovers, can be?
Really as crucial as anyone. He is the linchpin. By this point, not only police, but the family, the extended family with whom Jennifer is staying, have started to become a bit suspicious about her behavior. And police, through Jennifer's ex-boyfriend, Daniel Wong, find out that she had two cell phones. So the cell phone that they had already claimed from her and were searching through was just one. There was a second cell phone, and that was found on her desk, and the police managed to convince her to sign a waiver form for them to look through this phone. This was an iPhone, and the other phone was a sort of a Samsung flip phone. And it was a very difficult position for Jennifer to be in, because the family of Han Pan, his brothers and sisters, were starting to become suspicious and started questioning Jennifer as to why she was not telling police everything. At one point, she apparently said to her cousin that they didn't shoot me because they liked me. And at another point, she actually refused to go see the police under the guise of organizing her mother's funeral, and the family didn't like that.
Can you talk about the mother's funeral?
Yes. The detective showed up to the mother's funeral, and what they saw is quite unnerving. The story I tell in the book involves them sitting at the back row and Jennifer up at the front of the temple, sort of sobbing into her fists. The way it was described was that Jennifer was rubbing her eyes with her fist and sort of blubbering, I guess you could say, and continually looking up at the detectives to see if they were looking at her. But the one thing that they noticed was there were no tears. Now, this is confirmed by Jennifer's piano teacher, who was also at the funeral. And it was confirmed separately, independently of one another. She said the exact same thing, that Jennifer was crying and sobbing, but there were no tears.
Are you going to use this as an opportunity to take a short break to talk about our sponsor tonight, which is Blue Apron? Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. And Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients and building a community of home chefs. Now, Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States, and as a result, seafood is sourced and sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. Beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals. Produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S., and Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe. You get all the ingredients, all the fresh, incredible ingredients, gourmet recipes from their team, their culinary team, and it's delivered every week to your door. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with all the pre-portioned ingredients to make your own delicious home-cooked meals. You can choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. Customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. Blue Apron has several delivery options, so you can choose what fits your needs. And there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. It's easy, step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and it can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. And Blue Apron has a freshness guarantee that promises every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. Check out this week's menu, and you'll get your first three meals with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/murder. They have upcoming meals, spicy shrimp and Korean rice cakes with cabbage and furikake, pork chops and garlic piccata with scallion rice and spinach, which I loved, and mushroom and chipotle pepper enchiladas with lime sour cream. That was fantastic. So you'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/murder. Get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/murder. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. When we last left off, Jeremy, you were speaking about how their web of lies from Jennifer, and the case is closing in on young Jennifer, and some, the family members suspect her, her odd behavior at her mother's funeral. Tell us what happens next in this case.
So, the family are holding vigil around Han Pan's bed as machines sort of beep around him, and the doctor enters. Jennifer is there. She doesn't leave his bedside. And when the doctor enters, he's got good news. And he says to the family, Han Pan is going to survive. And we are going to bring him out of his coma. And he will survive with all his cognitive functions. And everyone is overjoyed, hugging, and there's loud chatter around. But there's one voice that comes through and asks the doctor a question. Jennifer says, but doctor, what if there's an infection? And the doctor says, there won't be an infection. We've dealt with this. Excuse me. Now, what happens next is possibly one of the most fascinating details. Jennifer immediately stands up and asks everyone in the room, if they have 50 cents for the payphone. And people find this odd. One of her uncles offers his phone to her. And she says, no, I need to use the payphone. And they say, well, what about your phone? And she says, my phone is dead. So one of the uncles gives her 50 cents, and she goes out in the hallway and calls her ex-boyfriend. And the police, the family would eventually tell the police, and they would search the phones and find out the call she placed. Now, the call went to voicemail. But the assumption became that she was calling her boyfriend to warn him that her father was about to survive. And if he did survive, their plan was in peril.
Now, you talk about, you introduce the character Detective Sergeant Larry Wilson. He's a major case manager, day-to-day tactical, and he has, along with him, is Detective Bill Cordes. And now he's been part of 80 murder investigations and lead on 5 of these. And another person, the number 3 on this team, is Detective Alan Cook. And Cook and Cortes work together. Now, there's no police consensus, like you say, and they have to follow the evidence as it unfolds. But this Alan Cook, he thinks this is an inside job, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's thought that the entire time from the get-go. Because, as I mentioned before, in his view, nothing is random. There's always a reason. But because after a particularly brutal case involving York Regional Police and a man by the name of Guy Paul Morin, who was wrongfully accused and convicted of a young girl's murder, police forces across Canada began creating new ways of doing things. So it's a triangle, and as you mentioned, there was 3 detectives, and the 3 detectives are there to ensure that they are not going on assumptions, because when you act on assumptions, you can often assumptions reinforce assumptions, and when you do that, it can lead to blinders being put on the investigation. And when that happens, often there can be wrongful convictions or wrongful charges. And that not only hurts the police force, it hurts the justice system and can lead to a case going unsolved. So the three officers are there to ensure that they're following the facts, not police assumptions.
You talk about just a couple days later, though, November 10th, Daniel Wong comes to Markham Police for his interview, and he's accompanied by his girlfriend, Katrina Villanueva. Now, this Daniel is 25. You say he was really respectful and willing to engage, but this group of police officers get some information from him regarding Jennifer that's very, very interesting. Tell us what they find out from Daniel Wong about Jennifer and her family and the relationship and how the family feels about that.
Sure. This is really where police start saying, all right, we need to shift our focus. Daniel Wong, as I mentioned earlier, he tells them about a second cell phone, which they then go and search for. But he also tells them about a life that is very far from the sort of boring, normal life that Jennifer says her family leads. He tells them about large amounts of cash within the family. He tells them about how he's a drug dealer. He tells them about how the family, the parents, Han and Bick, ended up ruining Jennifer and Daniel's relationship. He also tells them about countless lies that Jennifer's told throughout her life, including faking transcripts, faking an entire university career that lasted 8 years. He tells them that at the end of when Jennifer was caught in all her lies, Han locked her in the house for a year and a half and made her quit all her jobs and locked her in the house because he didn't trust her anymore. And he thought that Daniel was the source of these lies. Now, when police start questioning him about whether, you know, maybe the robbery was payback for his drug dealing activities, he starts to push back and starts to lead them down a path of what he thinks might be the reason for the murders. And he starts telling them about these odd crank calls he was getting, 100 a night sometimes, where the caller would leave cryptic messages and say very morose things, including, ha, 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 bang, 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 I'm going to get you. Things like this on his cell phone, on his email. And he would get these messages, Jennifer would get these messages, and Daniel's new girlfriend also got these messages. He also told them about Jennifer being gang raped by five Asian men, a story that she had told him. And the police then start saying, well, this is very, very different from the girl who had made herself out to be a little angel. And we need to start refocusing.
It's interesting. The Detective Mulligan casually asked Daniel how much it would cost to just take somebody out. And what was his answer?
That is very interesting. Mulligan does a masterful job during this interrogation where he essentially sort of buddies up to Daniel and starts talking to him about drug dealing and his involvement in the underworld, which is very minor, by the way. He was selling dime bags and making, you know, not even hundreds a week, I would say. He was just selling to friends and acquaintances. Anyways, by the end of the interview, they had built up a bit of a relationship, and at one point Mulligan asks him, so let's say you wanted to off somebody. You wanted to get rid of somebody. How much would that cost in the street? And Daniel, astoundingly, says $10,000. You could have somebody killed for $10,000.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, the police and Slade believe that now that Daniel has been spoken to, that likely Jennifer is going to try to contact Daniel to see what he has said and what was said.
Mm-hmm.
How do they proceed with this idea that this likely will happen?
So when they call Jennifer in again, they have a lot more information, and they're able to sort of twist and turn Jennifer all, through all sorts of hoops, trying to see what she's going to lie about. But you can imagine how unsettling it would be for detectives to find out how much deception this young girl was involved in, faking transcripts, faking a university career for 8 years of her life, which she had, by the way, never attended university. She hadn't even graduated high school. But her parents were under the impression that she had graduated from university and was planning on going to work as a pharmacist, which was Han's dream for her. Now, so they use this to get Jennifer to talk herself into circles. And it works to a certain degree. However, again, it's not cold, hard evidence. This is again a strange behavior and some questionable answers by a young woman. But soon enough, Han Pan will be awoken from his coma, and that's when some facts start coming out.
Now, they do get her to explain, now that they have this information, that she never bothered to impart to them the reality of this idyllic family, but really the 9 o'clock curfew she talks about. And so it looks like, again, it looks like a good reason to be resentful. So when she provides all this information that Daniel had already provided and she confirms some of that, what is her answer to the likelihood of this, there being some resentment and maybe then a possibility of retaliation? What does she say to that assertion?
She sort of dodges the question multiple times, in which Slade asks her, was there any resentment for your parents locking you down in your home and ruining your relationship? And she doesn't answer the question, and it's really fascinating to watch, and you can watch the interrogation videos on YouTube. I posted them on there. When she says, essentially, I love my parents, and I would do anything to stay with them. And she tells the story of how her father gave her an ultimatum at one point, in which he said, either you go with Daniel and we never talk again, or you stay home with us. And she decides to stay home with the family and to never talk to Daniel again. But that's, of course, not what she does. But that's the question that Slade keeps pounding. Was there any resentment? And she continually responds, no, I love my parents, and I would do anything for them, and that's all I have to say. Now, he at one point confronts her and says to her, this wasn't all just a plot you cooked up to get your parents out of the way? And she sort of puts her hand on her chest and with big doe eyes and says to him, oh my God, no, I would never do that. And he believes her.
Now, you profound part of this book is this, Han tells his family he doesn't really want to see his daughter. but she manages
mm-hmm.
to go to his bedside.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't confront her per se, but what does he ask her regarding Daniel, and what's her response?
He says to her, was Daniel involved in this? And she says, I'm not 100%, but I don't think so. Now, bearing in mind, Han hates Daniel and has always thought that it was his influence that has caused his daughter's life to go off the rails. Now, I also should mention that she was a very high-end figure skater, and she was basically a piano prodigy and a straight-A student in grade school. But when she got to high school, the lies began and her grades fell off. That's when she started manufacturing fake report cards. So he basically equates all her poor behavior with Daniel. But she denies it, and she makes it to his bedside, and she's sort of trying to manipulate him to tell the police what she wants him to tell them, which is that she had no involvement.
Now, you write in November 22nd now, we're talking just a few weeks after the murder,
mm-hmm.
another police interview, new interrogator, Detective Bill Gates,
mm-hmm.
and with a dramatic shift in interview style. He's a seasoned interrogator and polygraph expert, so he's a human lie detector, as he calls himself.
Yeah.
Now, what's his approach? You say he spends a couple hours gaining her trust, but what's this dramatic shift, and what does he get from her in this dramatic shift? What does she admit to, and who does she admit to?
So this is something something called the Reed technique, and this is a very controversial police technique that is used. Now, I'll just reference this film because I'm sure many of your listeners have seen it. It's the Netflix show in which Brendan Dassey is
right.
questioned by detectives. The Making of a Murderer, and
yeah.
he is the Reed technique basically involves a detective entering a room with a preconceived notion. So basically walking into the room, saying to this person, without saying it at the beginning, that basically, I know you've done this, so just admit it. It's controversial because of what happened in Brendan Dassey's case. People who have a lower intellect may go along with police assertions, or younger people may go along with police assertions because they want to make the person happy. So if they were actually innocent, they can be caught telling lies to the interrogator, basically implicating themselves in the murder, even though they may not have been involved, because the interrogator keeps accusing them. So essentially, Bill Gates, which is his name, sits down with her and starts off very unsympathetic, reads her her rights, asks her her name, and says to her, tell me your life story. So Jennifer begins regaling him with multiple hours of interesting details about her life, what she's done, her relationship with Daniel, her relationship with her parents, all the way through her childhood. And so he's gaining her trust. Now, at the drop of a hat, about 2 hours into the interview, it shifts. So he then goes from the happy-go-lucky detective befriending her to the accusatory detective. So he tries to justify the crime to her psychologically sort of saying that this is not your fault, Jennifer. Your parents were abusing you by locking you in the house. They were abusing you by having such high expectations of you. They were abusing you by wanting you to become a pharmacist when all you wanted to become was a piano teacher. And Jennifer basically goes introverted. She begins to put her hands over her ears. She puts her head between her legs. And Bill Gates just keeps talking, talking, talking. Now, Jennifer is in a chair with no wheels in a corner, and Bill Gates is in a chair with wheels. And slowly he goes from, and you'll see this in the interrogation video that's, again, on YouTube, he goes from one side of the room and slowly creeps up on her. And it's part of the Reed technique to basically be bearing down on the person. So make them feel as if they're a cornered animal, a caged animal, and they're being cornered. And slowly but surely they're in this large interrogation room, and when you're watching the surveillance images of them, he gets closer and closer to the point where he's basically on top of her and continually saying, I know you did this. It's not your fault. Just explain, why did you do this? Now, you didn't shoot them. That's a good thing. So just explain to me what happened, and we'll, you know, sort this out. Me and you are going to sort it out together. And after 4 hours, Jennifer starts to crack. And she says, first inaudibly, something you can't hear. And then she says it again when he prompts her, and she says, what happened to me? And then he basically goes in for the kill. She approaches the cliff and then jumps off it. He thinks he's going to get a confession, and she throws him a curveball. She says to him that she had tried to commit suicide multiple times. She had cut herself as a youngster, and she had mental health issues, and when she tried to kill herself, she failed. So she had essentially hired men to come in her house and kill her, to assassinate herself, is what she said.
Yeah, incredible. With this as well, he does get some other information from her, because he knows she's guilty, obviously. Does get some information about other people in terms of phone calls. So what information does he get from that interview, other than he knows absolutely that this woman did it, but he has this curveball to contend with? But what else does he get in terms of other suspects?
So she implicates men who turned out to be one man who ripped her off in an original murder plot, which didn't go through. And she implicates him as Homeboy. Now, I don't know if your listeners will know the movie Reservoir Dogs. I'm sure many will. Now, in Reservoir Dogs, you'll remember that the main characters had names like Mr. Pink and Mr. Brown and Mr. Blue. And the purpose of this was to hide their identity from one another, so that if any of them were caught, the police wouldn't be able to extricate someone ratting on someone else. And Jennifer had something similar. So she had one of her cohorts named, quote-unquote, Homeboy, was totally unknown to her. So she was communicating with this person over cell phone, talked to him just a few times, but mostly it was texting. And she was texting back and forth with this man, and had arranged a plot for men to come in and kill her. But instead of coming in and killing her, they came in and killed her parents. So What's found out from this is that there was a man named Homeboy, and they got the first three numbers of his phone number, and that there was a plot. But the plot that she was alleging was far different than the plot that the police were imagining in their mind.
They get a break in terms of phone communication through one company. And from that, they get, you say, a treasure trove of text messages and phone call information. Who's this company that they get this big gift from, and what do they discover in terms of the treasure trove of information?
So by now, police have managed to take Jennifer's other phone, which was an iPhone, from her bedroom, and found that she had received a number of calls in the lead-up to the murder. Now, when they opened the phone, they found that the SIM card was missing. She had called the police from her other phone, her Samsung phone. So they found the iPhone, but the SIM card was missing. And York Regional Police have a data extrication expert who managed to find the text messages and the records of who called and when from the iPhone itself, which was found. But again, the SIM card was never found. She had made calls in the lead-up to the murder with the SIM card, but then the SIM card disappeared. So the assumption is that she thought, if I get rid of the SIM card, police won't be able to find who was calling me and who I was calling. And that proved to be a very major error by Jennifer. Now, with that information, the police had the numbers who had called her. The problem with that was that each phone that had called her was one of these burner cells. Now, burners, it's a street word used to describe phones that can be purchased, prepaid phones that are purchased under, they can be purchased under false names, false addresses. They can be used and then tossed, basically. Now, all the phones that had called her, or most of them, were fictitious names. So police were stuck. However, one or more of the phones belonged to this company called TELUS, which is one of the three major cellular networks in Canada. And TELUS saves text messages. So although they didn't know who owned the phones, they were able to find what the text messages contained. So a lot of the text messages to Jennifer and the text messages out from Jennifer and the text messages amongst all the co-conspirators were discovered.
Now you get this, again, this incredible break, like you say, that TELUS has these text messages recorded for a certain period of time. So piece by piece, like you say, brick by brick, step by step, they bump into people that have something to say. And they talk to Ricardo Duncan, whose nickname is Rick. He comes in for an interview. What does he have to say about Jennifer, and what do they learn, which is very, very interesting to them?
So Rick tells them, he's one of the calls to this phone. Now, the Crown, the prosecutor, would later describe the iPhone as, quote-unquote, the murder phone. So she had her Samsung phone, which was for legit calls, and then she had the murder phone where she would coordinate and talk to all the co-conspirators. Rick, whose other street name was Reaper, told the police that at one point Jennifer had called him and they had met, and she had given him $1,200 to kill her father and her mother. But he had told her no and left it at that. And he said the money
now,
was to be used for a night out. He borrowed the money.
Now, there's another man that they hear from the phone calls that there's another person named Kimball that was in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how they find
mm-hmm.
out, that, again, piece by piece, and then they talk about Eric Carty. So how does that all lead to Lenford Crawford? How do police manage to tie all these people together and get to them?
This is possibly the most amazing thing about this case. And, you know, I'm no huge supporter of the police where I go around bigging them up. But this was really amazing. So essentially, the police take the 6 phone calls to Jennifer's phone. And some of them are burners, so they don't know who owns the phone. But they get the phone, the phone numbers, and they go through the phone numbers, all the text messages, which are saved from that phone. And they find a number of people that have been texted by the same person who was texting Jennifer. And they interview hundreds and hundreds of people and eventually find someone who identifies the person who was using the phone. Now, when they look further, they can see that some of the calls from that phone are going to about 15 other phones that were possibly being used by another co-conspirator. So the other co-conspirator was a very bright, street smart young man, and he was using about 10 burner phones that he had on him, and a number of his girlfriend's phones. Now, he had about 15 different girls that he was with, and he was using all their phones. So let me just break that down. There were more than 1 million bits of information. So phone numbers, calls, and text messages. Only the text messages from the Telus phones, again, one of the 3 big cellular companies here, were saved. So basically, they were just finding this phone number called this phone number at this time. And they created a huge web of phone numbers calling other phone numbers and found, through that, over numerous months, found that there were 5 co-conspirators. And they pieced together all the text messages and calls in the days leading up to the murder and the days following the murder, and could found a plausible story to describe what these people were doing.
Now, to just make matters worse for Jennifer, what happens with when they bring her in and finally arrest her? What is her reaction? And before we talk about all the other subsequent arrests, what is her reaction to that?
So she, by the way, after she makes that confession, the police arrest her and charge her with conspiracy to commit murder. And she's put in jail. And the public, when they find this out, that this girl is not the victim, but actually the perpetrator, some people are surprised, and some people are not that surprised. But the police are lauded for their effort in finding this out. Now, she's in jail, and police start wiretapping the phones of Daniel, her ex-boyfriend, and some of these burner cell phones that they've found contacting Jennifer. Now, when she goes to jail, the concern is, how are these guys going to get their money? So what happens is the perpetrators end up going to Daniel's house and threatening him with guns, saying, "We need our money."
Yeah. So what happens to facilitate their arrest after this incident with Daniel?
It's many months, but they essentially are caught out talking to one another. But there's one man that was never caught, and police this bright man that I was talking about earlier, the bright criminal. His name is Kimball. His street name is Kimball. And police can't nail this guy down because he has so many aliases. They're all code names. No one knows him by his real name. And he has so many burner cell phones and so many girlfriends that they can't actually locate him. But eventually they find a man in the database. This is the Canadian-wide database with the name, with the nickname Kimball. So police, when they're working, find out people's street names and put it in this database. And eventually the database comes up with a Kimball. And it turns out that Kimball's already wanted for murder. And he is eventually arrested. And Lenford Crawford, who was homeboy, was arrested. David Milvaganum, who was the man who called Jennifer in the lead up to the murder, he was arrested. And Daniel Wong was arrested. They were all charged with murder. And again, there's one man who remains the one man who remains free and uncharged, and he was actually the shooter, we believe.
Now, we don't have time to go into the other half of this incredible story, but you talk about Crown Attorneys Jennifer Halajian and Michael Rumble, and just the incredible amount of evidence that the police were able to present to them. And you go through the opening statements, of course, and it's interesting too, and I like that you put that when we talk about all these jurors that they had to go through, then this case was, this trial, a very, very lengthy trial, was set for 5 months. Eventually it was 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
And all the media attention on this. But, you know, the lowly jurors have to see crime scene photos and listen to this incredible testimony. After the 11th to the 49th day, they get $40 a day. And after the 50th day, $100 per day, or
mm-hmm.
no, pardon me, 11 weeks to 49. What? Anyway, what I found very interesting is the paltry sum you give people to serve on a jury and do what many of us, most of us, are not prepared to do.
For sure, and I've spoken to many of the jurors, and the case is really totally changed their lives, and I know I was. Just speaking to one of the jurors the other day, he had called me out for coffee to discuss the case. And he was discussing how it's changed his life and how he thinks about the men caught up in this crime every day. He was the foreman who actually had to read out the verdict and tried to stare at them all in the eyes while he did it, but they all looked ahead. But that emotion about sending these guys down to prison for 25 years, which is life in Canada, and they all had young children, they all had lovers and mothers and wives and girlfriends, and Jennifer, you know, a lot of them were Jennifer. you know, a lot of people called her evil and called her a monster and so on. But a lot of the people caught up in the crime were often described as normal, happy-go-lucky people who made a very bad decision. Now, these were the organizers, including Daniel and Lenford, who's homeboy. They organized the hit, and there were three men that entered the home and actually committed the violence. No one had any misgivings about putting them in jail. But the men who organized the hit and got 25 years, they all had children and jobs and were, you know, quote-unquote normal people. And he said he still thinks about them on a daily basis.
The really haunting part of the book is when the trial opens and the Crown opens with the 911 call with
mm-hmm.
Han Pan's horrific groaning with the 911 call in the background. And you also, through an interpreter, you talk about the incredible testimony of Han Pan, and it's difficult, and he doesn't look at his daughter. So for those that will wind up reading this book, they will
mm-hmm.
get to see a trial that, again, it looks like it's a slam dunk, but it takes 10 months. So there are problems and difficulties and some incredible stuff that goes on, including what Jennifer does and doesn't do at this trial. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about a daughter's deadly deception. For those people that might want to find out more, you talked about the YouTube links to find out more information in the videos that you posted. Do you have a Facebook page, and do you have a website for people that might want to follow up on after this interview?
Yes, I have the Facebook page is Daughter's Deadly Deception. The YouTube page is Jeremy Grimaldi, that you can see all the Jennifer's interrogation videos. My email is jeremy_grimaldi@yahoo.ca. And I'm really trying to engage with the reader on this one. This story, I've been immersed in this story for 2 years of my life, and it had a profound impact on me as a person and as an author and as a journalist. And the most bizarre thing from it all is that I still don't know if I know Jennifer. She's such a fascinating character, and her story is really stranger than fiction, and I know that's thrown around a lot, but this one is really odd and so layered, and so, as you can tell from our conversation, so much going on. I mean, we've literally just broken the surface of the story.
Yes, absolutely.
So I'm hoping people get in touch with me and tell me their thoughts on the book, and you know, there's question whether she was a sociopath or a narcissist or just a master manipulator and mastermind. But so I'd like to hear everyone's thoughts.
Well, I just say it's an incredible story. I mean, we've covered a few of these cases on True Murder before, but every one of them sends a shock through your spine, because it's so close to home when you read the, like you say, the deadly deception that Jennifer Pan does with her loving parents, and nobody ever can see the rationale for the murder, regardless of the treatment. Certainly, she had an odd treatment at home, but nobody can really sympathize with Jennifer Pan after hearing all these details of the murders. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about A Daughter's Deadly Deception. Thank you very much, Jeremy. Hope to hear from you again soon. Thank you for this incredible book and this interview. And you have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, you too.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.